Well, good evening, everyone. Let me welcome you to this, our latest LISI Visiting Speaker Programme. It gives me great pleasure this evening to introduce our speaker, Lauren Serede, who I first met a couple of years ago at what was a very, very good conference down at University of Texas in Austin on secession. And he's been spending this term or semester as over here in London, and it just seemed too good an opportunity to miss to have him come along this evening and speak on a subject which is obviously very close to my own particular area of research interest. And so the subject of this evening's speech will be on constructive incoherence, contesting Kosovo's status in the European Union. By way of brief background of our speaker, he joined the LBJ School of Public Affairs as a full-time lecturer in 2013 and had previously been adjunct professor at the LBJ School and Southwestern University. He holds a PhD in International Relations from Central European University in Budapest. He also has considerable policy experience within the institutions of the European Union. From 2005 to 2008, he worked as a press officer at the European Parliament, primarily focusing on the work of the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Parliament's relations with actors outside of the European Union. He returned to Brussels in 2011 to handle Hungarian language press communications for the European Parliament during Hungary's six-month presidency of the European Council. His research takes advantage of these experiences, focusing on the role of the European Parliament in the EU's foreign policy policy-making process, especially its parliamentary diplomacy. He also writes on the image of the EU as a normative power, the EU's contribution to the European security architecture, and various topics on transatlantic relations. So, Lawrence, the floor is yours.
All right, thank you. So, first of all, thank you to the LSE's European Institute and in particular the research unit on Southeastern Europe for inviting me, and special thank you to James for the personal invitation and the wonderful introduction. I want to possibly just stand up because I feel like whenever anybody talks to me sitting down, it's not the most dynamic thing. So I'm going to see if this clicker works as well. Beautiful. So this might be a little bit faster. So what I want to start with is this question of why I think this whole topic is interesting at all. So if you follow Kosovo, and especially Kosovo's relations with the EU, you might know that a month ago the EU signed a stabilization and association agreement with Kosovo. Right? And this is essentially the EU inviting Kosovo into a waiting room that could then lead to EU membership. I'm not saying how long Kosovo is going to be in that waiting room, probably a very long time, but it is still a significant step. At the same time, 5 out of the 28 EU member states do not recognize Kosovo as an independent country. Right? So to give you a somewhat exaggerated analogy, right? This is like having a club and saying, okay, this club deciding that it's going to consider for membership a ferry with one-fifth almost of the membership of that club not believing in ferries. Right? So it's kind of a weird situation. And because of this, the story of Kosovo-EU relations is a very weird sort of fairy tale. Right? And it all goes back to this very important moment of Kosovo's unilateral declaration of independence, which is what I'm going to talk about in the next 35 minutes or so, because that was the point that this really crystallized, this problem of what do we do with Kosovo's status. So what I want to do in the next, about 35 minutes or so, is give you a very brief introduction into the issue of Kosovo's status. Because we're here at the Southeastern Europe Research Unit, I'm not going to belabor this at all. I'm going to spend most of my time talking about the EU's incoherence with respect to Kosovo's status. And my argument is going to be actually that even though there's sort of an incoherence among all of these member states that have different views on Kosovo's status, the picture is actually much worse than even that would suggest. Right? And then I'm going to make an argument after this sort of really pessimistic sort of argument. I'm going to tell you why maybe that incoherence is not necessarily a bad thing. So, to give you very quick background, right? So you have Yugoslavia's disintegration in, you know, a couple of picturesque slides, right? And the few important points that I want to underline with regard to Kosovo status, right, is that after the Kosovo War, the UN took over the administration of Kosovo, and it basically became a territory that was under UN tutelage, under the UN United Nations mission in Kosovo. And the idea was, well, we'll have the UN take care of this province until we have a negotiated solution to Kosovo status, but this status process just fails at the end of 2007. So in 2008, Kosovo unilaterally declares independence, right? And this is when this becomes a question for the EU. Like, what do we do now, right? So what happens on 17 February 2008 when Kosovo is declared independence? Well, the US recognizes it immediately, no surprise there. A bunch of European countries actually recognize it almost immediately as well, including all the big ones, so Germany, France, the UK, Italy, etc. For reasons that are not going to surprise any of you, Serbia, Russia, and China do not recognize Kosovo at this time. Right? And the reason that Kosovo is sort of a perfect case of contested sovereignty is because as of today, out of the 193 UN member states, 108 recognize Kosovo, right? So it's almost exactly half. So it's a sort of perfect case of contested sovereignty. Now, within the EU, there are five member states that do not recognize Kosovo, right? And these are Cyprus, Greece, Romania, Slovakia, and Spain. And all of them have a problem with Kosovo because of the potential precedent that it would set, because all of these countries have significant minority populations and regions that might take a secessionist precedent to heart. See Catalonia right now in Spain trying to secede, right? So the EU's member states were actually quite incoherent when it comes to how to react to Kosovo's declaration of independence, right? So five of them vehemently oppose it, a bunch of them immediately recognized it. And if you want to have a very good discussion of how exactly this worked, James wrote a wonderful article on this that I would suggest that you all read. So this is already pretty bad when it comes to, or paints a bad picture when it comes to how the EU reacted to Kosovo's declaration of independence. And what I'm going to argue in the next few minutes is that this incoherence is even worse. Because not only did you have different member states react very differently to Kosovo's declaration of independence, you had the supranational actors and the EU institutions also react very incoherently. So the Council, the European Commission, and the European Parliament took very, very different approaches to how to react to Kosovo's independence, and even saw it through very, very different lenses or through very different frames. And this is what I'm going to talk about next. So I want to start with the Council, because this is where most analyses of EU foreign policy start, right? This is where the member states each send one minister and they meet in an intergovernmental setting. And what was interesting is that right after Kosovo declared independence, the day after they held a council meeting, right, clearly there was a need to react, five out of the then 27 EU member states, of course, did not recognize Kosovo. The rest, most of the rest did. And in the council, you have unanimity rules, right? So everybody has a veto. So because of this, right after the Kosovo Declaration of Independence happens, you have this wonderful statement come out of the council, which reads, and I want to read this to you because I think it's great diplomatic speak. The Council notes that member states will decide in accordance with national practice and international law on their relations with Kosovo. Right? So that's sort of diplomat speak for we agree to disagree. So because of the unanimity rule, the Council basically couldn't decide on or have a straightforward position on Kosovo's independence. And of course, we do need to emphasize that this may not matter too much, because of course the Council of the European Union doesn't recognize states. That's not what it's for. Right? Other states recognize states. Right? But it actually did lead to certain absurd outcomes, which are important for EU foreign policy. And to give you just one example, at some point the UN appointed an international civilian representative in Kosovo. And this person was supposed to help implement the UN Security Council resolutions and the plans for Kosovo. And it reported to what was called the International Steering Group. Don't worry about these names, they're not going to come up again, right? But the point is that this International Steering Group, under UN auspices, was populated only with countries that that recognized Kosovo. So this international civilian representative was to treat Kosovo basically as if it were sovereign. Right? At the same time, you had the EU appoint an EU special representative to Kosovo. Right? This was supposed to sort of set up the EU military mission, which I'll talk about in a little bit, or its security mission. And this reported to the Council, so therefore it could not treat the EU as, or it could not treat Kosovo as a sovereign state. This person was both of those things at the same time. Right, so Peter Faith, no wonder he looks like he has a headache, right? This guy had to both think of Kosovo as a sovereign state and think of Kosovo not as a sovereign state, right? Because he was in this sort of dual-hatted arrangement, actually in both positions at the same time, right? So these are the types of absurdities that come from this sort of incoherence. And what's also interesting is that for the Council, Kosovo, for the most part, was looked at through this very securitized frame. Right? What I mean by that is that already in 2006, so this is 2 years before Kosovo declared independence, the EU made it very clear that what it wanted to do is, as soon as all the dust settled, it would take over from the UN mission and it would be responsible for securing Kosovo and for taking over these soft security missions that the UN was providing. Partially because, of course, the EU had felt that it really dropped the ball on Kosovo during the war. So it quickly became clear that if it were to do this, this would be the largest civilian European security and defense policy mission that the EU had ever attempted. Right? So this was the EU was sort of setting itself up for this very big task. And when Kosovo declared independence, this became a major headache and an obstacle to launching this particular mission. Because you couldn't launch this EU mission to take over from the UN without the Russians and therefore also the Serbians agreeing. So for 2 years already from 2006, the Council was talking about Kosovo in sort of security terms. And because of this, the Council was really looking at the political problem of Kosovo's status as an impediment to this security mission. So how about the other EU institutional actors? Well, the Commission reacted actually quite differently. Right? So the European Commission, this is the more bureaucratic arm of the EU, looked at this problem from a very different frame. So for the Commission, Kosovo was mostly couched in terms of EU enlargement. Right? So the Commission was constantly negotiating with Kosovo on these details of how to get Kosovo to approximate its laws with European standards. And this involved a lot of very detailed negotiations, mostly not with a government, but with sub-government agencies on very technical details, right? I mean, in terms of what types of format a passport would need to have to be acceptable for the EU to allow people from Kosovo to enter the EU, things of this sort, right? So for the Commission, the UN mission in Kosovo was never really an interlocutor. I mean, they didn't have that sort of detail on these types of legislative issues. So because the Commission was constantly involved in a continuous dialogue with Kosovo on these types of technical details, it saw it through this enlargement frame. And for the most part, and this is interesting, so of course in the Commission there was sort of a consensus that the long-term future of Kosovo was within the EU, and this is the whole reason why we're involved in these accession talks. Even among member states, if you talk to sort of diplomats, right, of member states who don't recognize Kosovo, all of them are still saying, yeah, well, at some point it should somehow be in the EU. Right? That's not really the objection that they have, right? It's about the precedent. So for the Commission, Kosovo's status threatened to disrupt these existing processes of very detailed negotiations with Kosovo. And so how did the Commission respond? Well, it actually got very creative in its bureaucracy, right? And so what it did, and I'll just give you a few examples of this. One thing it did is basically copied everything that it was doing with the other Western Balkan countries and then just gave it a different name, okay? So you had stabilization and association processes with all the Western Balkans countries. You couldn't do that with Kosovo because it wasn't a sovereign state, so you had a stabilization and association process dialogue. Right? You just tack on a little word. Right? Everybody you talk to says this is exactly the same thing, it's just given a different name. The other thing that they did is added, or came up with this lovely little moniker of Kosovo asterisk. So the Kosovo asterisk is basically any time that the European Commission, for instance, on its website and other places, talks about Kosovo, it adds the little asterisk, right? And then somewhere you scroll down to the bottom of the page, right? There's a little picture of it, right? This is actually the European Enlargement website. Right? You have the little asterisk there, and you can't read this, but I'll read it for you. It says, this designation is without prejudice to positions on status and is in line with UN Security Council Resolution 1244 and the International Court of Justice opinion on the Kosovo Declaration of Independence. Right? So essentially what you're doing is burying the controversy in a footnote. Right? And I think at this point it's very interesting to know, right, that these are strategies that us academics use all the time. Right? So burying the controversy in a footnote if you don't know where to put it. You want to call something something, but it doesn't quite work, so you come up with a new name to talk about the exact same thing, right? So when people ask you, you know, do policymakers really learn from academics, you can point to this and say, yes, they do. And the third thing they did is basically showed strategic patience, which basically means they waited out treaty changes. Right? So the reason that this stabilization and association agreement could be signed last month, which I started the talk with, is that... the Lisbon Treaty conferred international legal personality on the EU, which means the EU can now sign international agreements. So what the Commission did is it knew that there would be a certain number of member states who would not ratify a stabilization and association agreement with Kosovo. So they waited until the treaty changes allowed it to come up with a stabilization and association agreement that only covered the competences that were exclusive to the Commission. It negotiated that and signed it, and the member states were sort of left out in the cold. Right. So the Commission basically was just using these sort of creative bureaucratic tools to sort of get around this problem that was trying to disrupt or threatened to disrupt these association processes. So last but not least, what did the European Parliament do? Well, essentially, the Parliament from the very beginning was a cheerleader for Kosovo's independence. Right? So as soon as Kosovo declared independence, the very next day, Parliament was actually in session in Strasbourg. The President of the Parliament made a big speech saying, well, this was expected and we respect the democratic will of the people of Kosovo. And fairly soon afterwards, the Parliament actually started passing resolutions that urged other member states and other EU institutions to also recognize Kosovo's independence. So it really became quite a cheerleader for independence. And the other thing that it did was to push for this sort of recognition through all sorts of fairly sneaky protocol precedents that it was trying to set. Okay, so to give you a few examples, whenever the Parliament held interparliamentary meetings with Kosovo, they would fly the Kosovo flag. Right? Before that, in all the EU institutions, they were always flying the UN flag to represent the UN mission in Kosovo. The Parliament was the first place where the Kosovo flag was flown in terms of within the EU institutions. You had the Parliament have these sort of bigger meetings, which were called interparliamentary meetings of the Western Balkans, where all these parliamentarians from the Western Balkans were invited. And they treated the parliamentarians from Kosovo the very same way that they treated them from Serbia or Macedonia or Albania. Right? You can imagine how well this went over with the Serbian parliamentarians, right? But they still did it, right? And so they were trying to sort of push these sort of policy precedents. The Parliament also, ever since 2006, has not used any asterisk or footnote or this other formulation which the Council used for at least a year after Kosovo declared independence of Kosovo under UN Security Council Resolution 1244, and that's always the phrase that was repeated. So the Parliament just always called it Kosovo. Right? So again, these sort of little protocol and diplomatic precedents, right? Because these then are resolutions that are sent to the Council. right? And then they become some of them become joint sort of European documents, right? European Union documents, these kinds of things. And of course, the reason that this was possible is because the parliament has majority rule, right? So of course, there were Greek and Cypriot and Spanish MEPs who were upset by this, but tough, they got outvoted, right? Which is something you cannot do in the council because there you have veto rights, right? So there's a very simple explanation for why this was possible. And it won't surprise you, right, that the parliament viewed Kosovo's independence and its status through sort of a democratic frame, right? In its resolutions, it's quite clear that it thinks that because the independence stemmed from the will of the people of Kosovo, it was legitimate. And what was interesting is that pretty soon after the Declaration of Independence was issued, the parliament actually started to focus on, not on the status itself, but on the state of democracy in Kosovo. So if you look at sort of resolutions from late 2008, 2009, 2010, they are actually concerned with, you know, how are the elections in Kosovo, right? So the parliament, for instance, sent an election observation mission to local elections in Kosovo. Usually the parliament doesn't ever observe local elections, only national ones. It made an exception because it's saying, no, we need to see whether democracy is actually working. And it was trying to see whether minority rights and linguistic rights and cultural rights were being respected, mostly for the Serbian minority in Kosovo, right? So what's interesting is that even though the parliament was quite a cheerleader of Kosovo independence and its sovereignty, it wasn't actually always friendly to the Kosovo authorities, right? A lot of times it was actually criticizing them quite harshly, saying, no, you can't, you know, just let, for instance, you know, Serbian graveyards be desecrated and not take action. But what's important is that it turned to the Kosovo authorities and said, you are responsible for reacting to these, right? So you are a sovereign country, now you need to act like one, right? So that was the sort of parliament frame of things. So all of this basically shows that not only did various EU member states look at Kosovo's independence in incoherent ways, but even the EU institutions had very, very different views of Kosovo's status and acted very differently, right? So essentially this is all bad news, right? I'm basically saying, hey, the conventional wisdom is the EU was incoherent, and I'm saying you don't know the half of it. It's actually much more incoherent than you even thought of. But this view is actually based on a very particular view of EU foreign policy, right? Namely that there's this assumption that in order for the EU's foreign policy to be efficient and powerful and somehow effective, it needs to be coherent, right? And what I want to do is see if I can poke a hole into that argument, right? And I don't want to give you a long literature review because I hate it when speakers go into literature reviews. You can come up to me afterwards and I can, you know, send you the paper and then you'll see this. But basically, there's this literature in EU studies about coherence, right? And the idea is there's two basic ideas, that the EU must act as a coherent unit in international affairs in order to be effective, right? This is the mantra that the EU must speak with one voice, right? For the past 50 years, we've heard the EU must speak with one voice, right? You have the sort of apocryphal Kissinger quote, right, of like, if I want to talk to Europe, who do I call, right? So the idea is there should be somebody who picks up the phone and who can actually pick up the phone and maybe dial somebody else, right? So that's the first idea. The second is that EU policies must be coherent, right? And this isn't just something that has to do with the EU. This is sort of something you can ask of any international actor. But the idea here is that you shouldn't have your development policy do this and then your security policies do that and your trade policies do a third thing and your human rights policies do another thing, and in the end it's just a big mess and you're not actually coordinating your various tools that are at your disposal. So if we look at the EU response to Kosovo sort of according to these two criteria, you see that the EU cannot be said to have been coherent and have spoken with one voice, right? So as I told you, there were some member states who were vehemently opposed, some member states who were, you know, gung-ho for Kosovo's independence, and the same thing goes for the various EU institutions. On the other hand, you also had these different types of policies. So EU Lex, which is the police and justice reform mission that the EU sent to Kosovo, EU enlargement, and these interparliamentary links, right, were also sort of incongruent in terms of how Kosovo should be treated in terms of its status, right? So Kosovo seems like a perfect case for EU incoherence and this EU incoherence inhibiting its foreign policy in practice. And intuitively, this sort of makes sense, right? That you really should, if you're the EU, you need to have a clear purpose and you need to have compatible tools to do foreign policy. And what I want to finish with is this idea that this intuition may actually be wrong, right? So, and this is what I mean by constructive incoherence. So the question, right, is, was the EU's policy effective? There's a long literature on what effectiveness means. I actually don't think that matters right now. Think of this as in very general terms. Like, did the EU get what it want? Right? And if you think about what were the real interests or preferences or the real goals of the EU in the region, right? How did the EU fare? Well, is Kosovo more or less stable, non-violent, at peace with its neighbors? I'd say yes. Right? I'm not saying it's a wonderful, you know, Shangri-La, but it's, you know, it's relatively peaceful. And I would argue that this is at least partly true because the EU mission on the ground was able to take over from UNMIC without much problem. And the reason that the EU was able to take over from the UN actually has to do with precisely this incoherence. So think of what would have happened if the EU had mounted a full-throated defense of Kosovo's sovereignty. There's no way that Serbia or Russia would have acquiesced to the EU sending mission there. Right? It would have been exactly as if the Americans had wanted to take over from the UN. Right? That would have been a no-go. At the same time, if the EU had just issued a blanket condemnation of Kosovo's sovereignty, I mean, the EU Lex mission would have had absolutely no legitimacy in the local population on the ground, right? How about sort of accession? Is Kosovo and in general the region advancing on the road to EU accession? I mean, I would say the signature of the Stabilization and Association Agreement last month would say, yes, it's advancing, right? Again, I'm not going to argue that this is ultimately going to result in membership anytime soon, but it's Kosovo is still on that path. More importantly, Serbia is still not completely off that path. Right? So why is that? Well, I would argue that, again, incoherence helped here. Right? If the EU had said unequivocally, Kosovo is not an independent state, there's no way it could have continued to have negotiations with it. Right? I mean, you can't, if you say, no, you don't exist, right? To get back to the silly fairy analogy, right? You can't say, I don't believe in fairies. Okay, now let's have a negotiation with fairies. You can't have both. Right? On the other hand, I think it's also very important that the European Union never came out in sort of full support of Kosovo's independence, because that would have probably thrown Serbia totally off the EU integration path. Right. So it's important to remember that the EU has never made a formal criteria to Serbia to say, you must recognize Kosovo before we will let you into the EU. Right? And that, I think, is important. If it had said that, I doubt that Serbia would still be at least sort of nominally interested in this association process. And finally, you know, is Kosovo progressing in its relations with its neighbors, which is basically code for relations with Serbia, right? And I'd say yes, because there was this deal in 2013, right, at the end of the Pristina-Belgrade dialogue, that basically brokered some sort of normalization of ties between the two countries, right? And this was partially due to, well, I would say, quite a lot due to the sort of mediation efforts of Cathy Ashton, the EU's Common Foreign and Security Policy High Representative. You can tell it was a good deal because they all look equally miserable in the picture, right? But think about what allowed Lady Ashton to be a credible intermediary between the two. if the EU had been, again, sort of gung-ho on Kosovo independence, you know, it wouldn't have, you know, Ashton wouldn't have had any sort of respectability or clout with Serbia and vice versa, right, with Kosovo. And you can tell this, right, because there's a reason that the US wasn't involved in this dialogue, for instance, right? It's because the US was clearly seen as partisan in this, right? They could not be a neutral mediator. So because the EU had this sort of weird, incoherent view of Kosovo's independence, it was able to play a mediating role. Plus, of course, it had the leverage of accession funds and the general accession process to sort of, you know, use as a carrot slash stick to bring the two sides to the table. So I would argue that the EU's sort of main goals with respect to the Western Balkans and Kosovo in particular were actually helped by the EU's incoherence that I've described. And you might find that this is fairly hypothetical, right? I was just thinking, well, what if the EU had done this? What if the EU had done that? But if you speak to Commission officials and Council officials and European Parliament officials, they actually tell you, right? They say, listen, we had a lot of trouble, you know, I talked to a council official and say, well, we had a lot of trouble trying to sell this EU-Lex thing to the Serbs and the Russians, and it really helped that the council didn't officially recognize Kosovo. And then the fact that the parliament was actually gung-ho about it sort of eased the minds of the Kosovo authorities that we were talking to. And then you talk to commission officials, right, they say, listen, when we're doing these accession negotiations, it's sometimes a problem that Kosovo is like, well, but you don't recognize us, and we can say, but listen, you know, the parliament that is there to sort of push for both your independent status claim and for EU accession for you, so you have a friend inside the EU. So this is actually something that the people working on this do actually see as something that's happening in real life. So my conclusion is that, you know, while the EU literature might say that there's a lot of incoherence in terms of the EU's relations with Kosovo, I'm not sure that this necessarily undermines the EU's effectiveness in its foreign policy, and that the EU's incoherence can actually sometimes be an asset for its activities. And so there is a room for this idea of constructive incoherence in EU foreign policy. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that incoherence is always an asset, right? So if you ask me for a sort of policy prescription for how do we make EU foreign policy better, I wouldn't say, well, just become as scatterbrained as you can and everything's going to go fine, right? That's not the point that I'm making. I'm just saying sometimes this idea that EU foreign policy needs to be coherent may actually not be true. Right, so in terms of EU foreign policy, coherence may not be all that it's cracked up to be. So with that, I'm just going to stop here and then take your comments and questions and suggestions. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Lawrence. Very interesting talk. And floor is now open if anyone's got some particular questions they'd like to ask. Yulia, perhaps if you could just identify yourself.
Yes, I was just about to ask.
Hello, Yulia, I'm a PhD student here at the embassy. My research is actually also on the negotiations for independence.
Mm-hmm.
I was quite struck by what you said, because it's actually something I also found out in my interviews that within the commission, officials usually feel, well, we just have to work around this whole constructive ambiguity, and you know, we're doing this to appease those five states, and we're doing all, you know, all the sing and dance, so they're happy, but actually we do know what we want. We want Kosovo to be a member of the EU. And my question is, when do you think that happened? When do you think commission officials started to think that's the only way forward, and we're just going to have to play along for a while until that happens? Because we say it's 2006 when the EU committed, or 2008 when it actually happened, or maybe 2010 when they got tired of actually having to deal with this back and forth all the time. And what would you say?
So let me give you a very micro answer, and then if my mind works enough, I might have a very big answer at the end of this. The micro answer, I think, is comes from human psychology. So if you speak to a European Commission official, right, they're working day and night on the dossier of Kosovo's accession to the EU. So imagine if, you know, you worked on your PhD for, you know, 5 years, and I mean, for this, it's, you know, it's 9 years now, right? It's very unlikely that at the end you're going to be like, oh, I don't really care what comes out of this, right? So I think in general, people working on these kinds of things, from a psychological point of view, we always say, well, of course Kosovo belongs in the EU, because otherwise what I'm doing is a complete waste of time, right? I've just wasted my entire professional career on a footnote that nobody's going to remember in history. No, but I think this is important, right? Especially if you're doing interviews. Like, you need to think about this. On a macro level, I would say there has probably been a sort of progression. So at the beginning, they may have said, okay, well, this is a political problem. Let's see if we can fix it. And the more that these five member states have sort of stuck to their guns, the more annoying they get, right? So a good sort of analogy to this, I don't know this about the Kosovo case, but I know this about the Macedonia case, right? So with the Macedonia case, there's this name problem, right? There's one member state that has its panties in a bunch about the name of Macedonia, right? For 5 years where I was working in the EU institutions, everybody was sort of going along with the motions, right? And what I noticed is sort of year after year when this problem came up in the Foreign Affairs Committee of the European Parliament, you know, every time somebody would write the report, they would just say Macedonia, and then, you know, some Greek member would come up with all these amendments that basically replaced Macedonia with former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia everywhere, right? And then nobody wanted the acronym, so then the amendments got too long. And in the beginning, it was always like, okay, fine, we'll do this. The fourth year that I was there, I remember just the entire committee just basically shouting down these people, like, we are so sick and tired of hearing about this, just shut up, right? They started calling them, well, our fellow members of the European Parliament from the former Kingdom of Greece, right, to sort of poke fun at them, right? So I think partially it's just a sort of frustration that builds up, right? And I think what you see is that bit by bit, this can be worn down. So if you think about, for instance, this Kosovo asterisk notation, now the council uses it well. It refused to use it for about a year and a half, I think. I'm not quite sure. At least a year and a half, it still used this sort of Kosovo under UN Security Council Resolution 1244 and all of its documents. By now, if you look at, for instance, the EAS website or even the council website and the council conclusions, they just use the little asterisk, right? So you can just sort of wear them down with these.
And
kinds
even
of
actually,
things.
Just on that, I've noticed that recently there have been a few documents produced where they actually haven't even included the asterisk, and you know it's just, you know, and a few sort of sharp-eyed people noticed it, but it, you know, so it's interesting. Even there, it's becoming even less used that.
Yeah, but I don't think so. To answer the other question, I don't think there was sort of a political moment in terms of EU-Kosovo relations that would have led to this shift. I think it was all sort of internal and more sort of gradual build-up.
I'm going to jump in and ask a question. I mean, it's really interesting because you sort of said that there is this sort of wearing down and things, but to what extent do you get the impression, certainly, I mean, I think focusing on the Commission here, but it would also be interesting to hear what you think from the Parliament point of view of the nationals of the five non-recognisers, when you speak to them within the Commission, do they feel any sort of sense that they should be defending national positions, or do they sort of throw their hands up in exasperation and say, oh, you know what, I just don't understand. Well, I do understand why Nicosia takes this position, but, you know, being realistic. And the same with the parliamentarians, because, I mean, if you look at some of the voting patterns, it is actually quite interesting that there have been opportunities where reports come and maybe there is the willingness of MEPs to pass the report, but they want to make their point about it, and so can vote on an amendment or whatever. And I can think of one or two occasions, for example, where people who one would, well, not even peg, they are hardliners. Greek Cypriots, for example, have voted for the report or the statement or the resolution, which quite clearly is a statement that would recognise Kosovo as an independent sovereign mm-hmm. state. And so just your sense on, yeah. On how this works.
I have a better insight into the parliament, and so I think in terms of MEPs, right, I think this is probably a good gauge of how Europeanized they are, right? So you have sort of certain parliamentarians who owe their seat but also their sort of professional allegiance back to their home country, right? So it still happens that sort of, you know, people whom, you know, certain parties want to get rid of, they just send to Brussels, or, you know, it's sort of a present for having done some good campaign work, these kinds of things. But then there are those MEPs who have made a European career in terms of, you know, they have dossiers that they have followed in the European Parliament for a while, and they've sort of created a European network for themselves, right? Once you do that, you can't just be petty and national, right? You sort of start thinking more in terms of the European interest. So I think it depends on whether they have been Europeanized in that sense. It could also almost be sort of a little measure of how Europeanized they are. But the other thing is, you know, I mean, I heard this great story the other week, and this doesn't directly answer your question, but it's too fun of a story not to tell. So I'm going to pretend that this is going to answer your question. In the parliament, there are sort of internal IT systems, right? So when you go on a mission to, Kosovo, you need to book it through some sort of internal IT system, which relies on some sort of international standard. So when you flew to Pristina, it said Pristina, Serbia. So, of course, all of these MEPs were saying, well, no, this is wrong. We want it to say Pristina, Kosovo, right? So, in essence, this staff member I was talking to had to placate these MEPs by constantly calling the IT services and being like, can you update your system so that when I put in Pristina, it brings up Kosovo on the little mission order, right? And this guy was telling me that actually it depended on whether you got a Spanish IT person or a Belgian one, whether it got through. Because if you called the Spanish one, no dice, right? It wouldn't happen. And so you'd have to call again and try to get another person, right? So this is on a very, very technical staff level, right? But apparently even there, national allegiances matter, right? I mean, it's not like you would think that the IT services of the parliament are really where, like, national politics play out, but apparently it is, right? Coda to this, by now, if you do travel to Kosovo from the parliament, it says actually Pristina, Kosovo, so they actually changed it, right? And then the lawyers got all upset because it meant that, you know, if you're traveling with the commission, then the two papers don't say the same thing, so you might have legal problems with insurance and everything. So, like, imagine how much manpower, man hours go into this kind of stuff, right? And this is another sort of absurdity, right, that I didn't want to tell in detail. But these are the types of things that go on. So it's not just MEPs or even commission officials, right? It's the sort of the IT back office, right, where nationality matters, right? So when you're thinking about how do you create, you know, European citizenry, I mean, it goes down to the roots. You need to convince all of these people to think in European terms, which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Looking at the more global thing beyond the EU, beyond the US, and beyond Serbia, and I'm from Serbia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. One very important step to Kosovo independence was, of course, that there has been the war, we called it the Kosovo War. The countries that were involved all flagrantly broke the UN Charter in order to do that. So, I mean, that has a great importance. I mean, this is about the very basis of the United Nations. Obviously, Russia and China have something to say about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, such a thing can be repeated elsewhere if one doesn't make a stop on this. UN Resolution 1244 has not been observed. It has been when it suited those who were effectively in occupation of Kosovo, and these were the NATO countries. On top of that, the US, to all intents, it's their project. I mean, they led the whole thing. And since I followed the whole thing, it's very clear that the Europeans, pretty much most Europeans, were very reluctant in participating in this. So we have basically a EU versus the US position, I would suggest to you.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons is that the EU doesn't really know exactly what the US wants. Or that the US, what the US wants and tells them is something that is in some way unacceptable. Of course, we now have certain other things that appear, the Crimea. The Russian Federation will make a comparison. They said, we haven't bombed anyone in the Crimea. We haven't dropped a single bomb on anyone. Look what's happened there. Can I just point out that you mentioned the minorities? 80% of them on the territory that is under the control of KFOR are no longer there. They've been registered refugees, mainly in Serbia and elsewhere. They've been killed and expelled. Nobody has had to leave the Crimea. The salaries of the state employees in the Crimea have been doubled as a result of joining Russia.
And you're a little bit off.
I know it, but it's the comparison is being made continuously.
Well, but here, let me say two things about that. So the first is, I think there's a good point here about sort of US-EU dynamic on this,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I would say that if you're looking for examples where, there's sort of, interventions and sort of U.S. foreign policies that then the EU gets to sort of clean up at the end, Kosovo is just one of several examples, right? So I think you can see similar things going on in the Middle East, et cetera. The other thing, though, is this idea, right, that sort of the entire international legality of Kosovo's Declaration of Independence, but also before that of the intervention, right? What I think is interesting is that a lot of times this gets discussed in terms of the UN not giving its backing to the NATO operation, in terms of the international legal precedent that Kosovo sets, all these things. What I think is interesting in the EU case is that for all those five member states that don't recognize Kosovo, I don't think they care. They don't recognize Kosovo because of their own domestic minority problems. So they, I think sometimes they sort of try to create these arguments of, well, this is because we respect international law. I think that's actually all instrumentalized. The reason that Greece and Cyprus and Spain and Slovakia and Romania don't want to recognize Kosovo has nothing to do with the UN, with international law, with precedent, with frozen conflicts, with what it's going to have to say about Crimea or other frozen conflicts, right, about the Georgia crisis. That's where Kosovo came up, fairly soon after its declaration of independence. I think in that sense, the opposition within European member states to Kosovo's independence is actually all internal. That doesn't mean it doesn't have international effects, but I think in terms of it's not a prime cause at all.
It's interesting you say that, because it does seem, I think essentially I'd accept that it was very much driven by internal factors in the five non-recognizers. But one of the things which I've heard said to me is that, and there's somebody else in the audience, so I think Cope will chime in on this in just a second, but there was a point about 2 years ago, and it would be almost 2 years ago now, where it was felt that Slovakia, Romania, and potentially Greece were absolutely on the verge of recognition. And then Crimea came up, and then they wheeled it back after that. That it then sort of said, look, this has actually vindicated the public statements we've made that this is about protecting international law. So in a strange sort of way, although it might have been for whatever domestic reasons, however those were set up, it has been very interesting that Crimea has scared them off in a way that, for example, I suppose you could have argued that the same would have been with Abkhazia and South Ossetia, but obviously that took place roughly at the same time as Kosovo, so they were saying.
Yeah.
But, that really does seem to have set back the case. And at the moment, it certainly seems that highly unlikely that either Slovakia or Romania are going to recognise. And for that reason, Greece is really teetering on the edge, but I don't think it wants to jump on its own at the moment.
I think I would buy that argument. I think with Slovakia and Romania, there's also the fact that Hungary is, in terms of its rhetoric, is becoming much more open to charges that it is flaming secessionist ideas.
Mm.
Right. So there's, but I don't, but I think I get your point. I mean, it also could be a sort of essentially rhetorical entrapment, right? You say, well, but we did this for international legal purposes, and then all of a sudden it becomes relevant, right? And then you're like, okay, well, we can't look that hypocritical, right? So I mean, I think that that's certainly true. All I'm saying is that the original reasons for not recognizing, I think we're much more selfish than grand principles of international law, which. Yeah.
On that note, Katharina over there.
Yeah, hi, thank you, James. My name is Katharina Lizzo. I work at Goldsmiths University as a visiting research fellow. First of all, thank you for your presentation, very interesting. I wrote my PhD on the Slovak view on Kosovo's independence.
Mm.
So it was a really interesting process to kind of see how that sort of opinion was formed and what kind of looked at the beginning as really sort of constructive decision had sort of some layers underneath. And I would agree with you that it was an internal decision for Slovakia. One aspect was the Hungarian minority. There was also Hungary itself playing a role and the kind of Hungarian MPs emphasizing rights of ethnic Hungarians at that moment quite sort of openly. And also there were some issues between political parties going on in the parliament, and that was not that much talked about in the public. So it was internal, then presented as kind of external, and the international law argument never harmed anybody, and Slovakia stuck with it. And as you said about sort of the constructive incoherence, I would also support sort of this view, because at the beginning Slovakia was seen as a kind of a problem, and one of the countries that was probably least expected to kind of stick with the decision for that long, because it's the smallest, and in the past it used to really kind of go with the mainstream in the EU, but then it sort of like stayed within this group of five. And also when I interviewed some officials in the commission or spoke to Slovak representatives, they kind of, it was said to me that Slovakia found the best way out to disagree, really, and it never really harmed its position, and it had the leeway to speak with Serbia and also with Kosovo. And I would even say that it kind of helped Slovakia to develop its relations with Kosovo. And even sort of, if you look at the Visegrad countries, I would sort of say that Slovakia has best sort of developed relations in terms of contact.
Mm-hmm.
And the visits sort of Kosovo representatives coming to Slovakia. So I think being sort of in the middle, that kind of helped. And I would support your argument with the sort of constructive incoherence that in this case it really helped the EU.
Well, and the question is, and this would be interesting, I don't know much about sort of specific links between different Visegrad countries and Kosovo, but I'd be interested to hear about that. But I think it also, I mean, let's add here that so far, not recognizing Kosovo has not had huge actual costs, right? Because of what I was talking about with the sort of commission being able to finagle its way around it, right? So if at some point, you know, it comes up to Slovakia to say, okay, is Kosovo in or out? Then it's a much tougher decision, right? As long as you're, you know, you can sort of make this decision, you're part of, first of all, you're part of five other countries, so you're not totally isolated, and it doesn't actually affect people, you know, you don't look like a terrible person, right? Whereas it would look very different if Slovakia was saying, oh yeah, everybody wants Kosovo in the EU, but you know what? We're going to be the one standing in the way. I mean, that is a very different proposition. So I think up till now, there's also been this, another enabling factor is the fact that it hasn't had a huge tangible cost yet to have this incoherence in that sense.
And also interesting, as the point was raised, I mean, you've had a very active foreign minister in Slovakia who I don't think there's any doubt as to where his personal preference lies, that, you know, he would have recognised immediately. But, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in actual fact, so you actually have a very active diplomatic engagement without recognition on the part of Bratislava. But I don't, if I recall right, Poland and the Czech Republic, although they have recognised Kosovo, actually haven't established diplomatic relations with it. So that you've actually got a rather interesting case that the countries that don't recognise are engaging much more actively than some which just, in order to go through the motions, have said, look, we'll recognise, but then for whatever internal reasons have said, look, we've done our bit, we recognise as you wanted, but actually aren't following that up with sort of intense day-to-day activities. It sort of makes rather more complicated. It's not this sort of binary recognition good, non-recognition bad. Actually, you can have non-recognisers who actually have a much more sort of positive and constructive relationship than recognisers. Please.
Yeah, hi. My name is Mario Swani, and I'm from Kosovo. I'm doing a master's degree in development studies with the hope of going back and contributing to development. Actually, with the point that you just talked about like half-recognizers, I would add that Greece is a half-recognizer because it actually recognizes the passport.
Greece actually recognises an all but name. They've welcomed the Kosovo foreign minister to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Athens and introduced him as the foreign minister of Kosovo, but then simply said, but we don't recognise Kosovo still, so it's all right. But, you know, it's incredible. Greece actually has rewritten the rule book on diplomatic relations without recognition. I'll be happy to talk about that at a different time. But anyway, my pet thing.
Yeah. And I'm completely aware of the whole airport thing that you mentioned, and I still deal with it after 8 years of having declared independence. I still have trouble with that. But with respect to the Crimea case, I would definitely agree that the Crimea case and the Kosovo case are the complete mirror images. On the one hand, NATO having to bomb Serbia, and on the other hand, Ukraine peacefully annexing Crimea. But I would also like to add that in the Kosovo case, there was an active ethnic cleansing by the Serbian authorities that almost bordered on genocide. And so again, this is a complete mirror image of the Crimea case. And with respect to the UN resolution, I would like to draw attention to the one of the clauses. I can't recall the clause of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which explicitly says that states are required to look after their citizens. And Serbia did not fulfill this quote, which in a way legitimizes the UN intervention.
Yeah, I mean, so you have certainly this sort of, and this is what I think is actually interesting, is that a lot of times when you get into this, and this is sort of the debate around Kosovo and Serbia, right, you get to this debate about the legality of the intervention, right? And there's a reason that I actually didn't talk about that in terms of how the EU saw this, right? It's because what I think is interesting is that disregarding all of that, right, the real issue for the EU, as I see it, wasn't really at that point. It was actually before. It was when all of this started, and the EU, after sort of Bosnia, had said, no, we screwed up once, we said this was our neighborhood and we're going to take care of it, we failed miserably. Never again. And then Kosovo happens. The EU's nowhere to be seen. Complete failure again, right? So I think what's interesting is that it's sort of that sort of big debate that should have maybe happened at, you know, in the EU, and of course it didn't really have a common foreign security policy at that point, or it was just very nascent, but the one that they didn't have then, that's what I think they sort of retroactively had with the independence claim of Kosovo, right? And that's why I think it also saw, as I was saying, that how the council, especially the sort of member states, saw this as a security issue, where they said, listen, we screwed this up and we're totally absent in 1999, so now we want to make sure we do right by everybody, right? So we want to come in and take over from the UN and take care of this place, right? And that's why they saw it in such security terms. And I think it's interesting that's where the real debate sort of started on Kosovo status, and it wasn't earlier, but again, that has more to do with sort of EU politics.
Hello, my name is Ellie Bumetnikova, and I'm a visiting fellow here. I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on the dynamics between the Commission and the External Action Services, because basically when they were set up and Catherine Ashton had so many hats to deal with, basically there was very little description about the workload division between back DG enlargement and the External Action Services. And when I was doing my interviews, I mostly met Commission officials, and I was basically trying to ask them if they had any issues or any problems. And they said, no, we don't have any precise, clear-cut division of labor, but everything is working fine. So this was the answer that they get all the time. And I was wondering what the what are your impressions, or if you think that this has added to the incoherence of the union's approach, or not really?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things. I think the fact that sort of the commission, parts of the commission, you know, sort of migrated to the EEAS, and you have this big external action service that does not include enlargement, creates more incoherence, right? Because how can you call relations with Kosovo not foreign policy? I mean, it is foreign policy, right? On the other hand, you also have, I think, especially in sort of, so the under the Mogherini version of the External Action Service and the way that the commission has been organized under Juncker, you see a general downgrading of enlargement as a priority area, right? So there's no longer DG enlargement, it's DG neighborhood policy and enlargement negotiations, am I, if I'm correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. So not enlargement, just negotiations. Right? It's a big difference, right? Whether you're just saying, oh, these are talks, or there's a finality to these talks, right? In terms of staff, they were cut. They're no longer in the Berlin Monde, they're out in some other building, right?
Yeah, they've moved.
They moved, right? So all the sort of little signs point to the fact that, like, this whole idea of EU enlargement is much lower on the totem pole than it used to be, right? So there's partially just incoherence problem, but also it's not just that it's in two different places, it's that one of those places is sort of sinking in importance, both politically and also sort of in terms of resources and finances and these kinds of things. So so I would say that these things increase the EU's incoherence on the matter, and possibly if you're thinking about, you know, the commission as I sort of described it was mostly the enlargement people, if you're looking to them to sort of find these creative, you know, bureaucratic solutions, of course, the less power they have, the less likely they are to be able to maintain these or to come up with new ones, right? So I think the general trend, if I'm right, should be towards more incoherence on this.
Go on, it's going to be, but not a NATO rant, please.
Can Kosovo, bearing in mind how small it is and relatively underdeveloped, actually survive as an independent state without direct economic assistance from the European Union? And just to point that out, I mean, Kosovo is Serbia, means Serbia has to pay for Kosovo development, or that it has done in the past. So funds have been coming from the richer part of Serbia, if you like, to one of its autonomous regions. That happened within the whole of Yugoslavia as well, additionally. It was a socialist state. But who is going to make that up now? You know, we are just speaking here about words, administrative things, and so on. How much funding has the EU taken up from this? On top of that, you have something, you know, when we say Kosovo is Serbia, it has actually developed as part of Serbia. For example, the entire energy system, including the Trepča mine and so on, was a network in that whole area. And now when you break it, both sides lose. There's no question about it. Now, is the EU just going to take over that, right? And how big a budget have they put aside?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is actually going to be the big question, right? Is that, you know, I would sort of agree that if the idea were let's create some sort of independent Kosovo and, oh, it'll just turn into Luxembourg, right? I mean, that's not realistic. So I think if you talk to people in the EU of how they view this, right, the idea is let's sort of keep this sort of pre-accession assistance going until they can join, right? And once they have joined together with the other Western Balkans countries, then basically it won't matter whether they're independent or not because they'll be part of this bigger whole, right? Which, I think, and this is the important part, presupposes, I think, a sort of big bang enlargement that you can bring in all the Western Balkans countries together. Because if you want to bring, you can't bring in Serbia before Kosovo, or Serbia is going to block Kosovo. You can't bring in Kosovo before Serbia, or it's going to be the opposite. Albania is basically part of this package too, right? Because, right? So at that point, you're basically faced with this question of, okay, when do we bring all of the Balkans in, right? You sort of picked off Slovenia and Croatia. I don't think you can pick off anymore. I think where we stand. But the problem then is, you know, when is the EU going to be really ready to bring in the rest of the Balkans? And also, I think in Serbia's case, is Serbia really interested? And how long is Serbia going to be interested? So I think the sort of answer that you'd get from the EU is, well, we don't want it to be an independent state. We want to bring it and Serbia and all the other countries into the EU. But again, I think there's a lot of papering over the question, and here I would agree with you, of, okay, but if that happens only in 30 years, like we need to wait one generation, and even that I think is, you know, potentially optimistic, then are we going to pay for all of this for 30? Are we going to basically do what we did for, you know, the Eastern European countries, which they did for 10 years, and it actually cost a lot of money, right? Basically German money to bring up, you know, all these Eastern European countries to join the EU. Are we going to do the same thing for the Balkans, right? Somewhat, you know, smaller population, so it's a little bit more doable perhaps, but I don't see very much appetite for this in the EU at present. So at a certain point, I think this question exactly is going to come up, is, okay, well, what's our goal here, and can we actually promise accession to all of these countries? Because that, again, I don't think you can promise accession to one without just blowing up the whole thing for political reasons, which I think fairly obvious.
Sorry, I'm just tempted to make one quick comment on what you just said. I can see why this is a significant point, and many have tried to speculate about 2014, 2018, and I'm sure it's going to be a very divisive issue. But if this is to be the case, this is completely counteractive towards the new EU enlargement strategies to basically treat each individual candidate countries based on their merits and on their progress, which we can see how it even significantly weakens further the credibility of the accession process with the Western Balkans, because not only this time we don't have a timetable or any idea how and when it's going to happen, but this time we have much more sensitive issues to deal with in the first place. It's slightly compromising, again, the consistency and the coherence of the EU's approach towards the Western Balkans region.
Not slightly. I mean, I think fundamentally, right? I think this idea that, you know, the EU is going to look at sort of some technical criteria for accession, I mean, that's, I don't think anybody believes that. I mean, maybe that's somewhat cynical. I don't think anybody believes it. Even the people who wrote it don't believe it. I mean, it's, you know, I just don't think it's true. I mean, the Western Balkans are a political project.
There was not much political will invested in it.
Yeah. It's an orphaned political project, but it's still a political project. No, I mean, I'm agreeing with you. I think you're right. It does undermine that sort of notion that this is going to be according to some technocratic criteria. On that cheery note.
Not quite. I was going to ask, I mean, you mentioned a very, very interesting example, and it does seem a very long time ago now, but obviously it wasn't. It was the whole question of Peter Fyfe and that double-headed or double-hatted role that he had. I mean, how was that seen within the Commission? Was there amongst council members? Because it really was completely ludicrous. I remember when he came and spoke here, and he kept having to stress which particular capacity he was speaking in. Because if he was speaking as EUSR, he could not, under any circumstances, refer to Kosovo's independence. And it was all very technical about what the EU was doing. But as soon as he spoke as the international civilian representative, then he was there specifically to not just speak about Kosovo's independence, but he actually saw it as his role as advocating, absolutely. You know, how did they manage this and view this within the Commission? Because it was one of the most ludicrous situations I think we've seen in recent years.
I actually don't know. And I think what I'd be even more curious about is how did he himself feel about this? But also how did the authorities in Serbia and Kosovo, for instance, feel about this, right? Because it's not just doublespeak, it's sort of, you know, institutionalized doublespeak, and it's just kind of random. So I haven't had a chance to talk to him or really to talk to the Commission about this. I think to a certain extent, because his role as EU Special Representative was less, at least in the beginning, was more about the EU Lex mission and setting all that stuff up, the Commission could sort of, I don't want to say ignore him, because that's not, it wasn't that active, but I don't think they had to deal with his office on a day-to-day basis, because they were, again, dealing mostly with the sort of, you know, sub-government agencies and things like that, and they were doing negotiations on technical things. But I think later on, when the EU, you know, special representative and the sort of EU, there was another great pseudonym for this, the liaison office, which was not a delegation, but a delegation under a different name, you know, when those were sort of essentially merged, then I think it became a bigger problem. But I don't know the details of who, sort of how that worked in terms of the in the Commission's eyes, because I haven't talked to anybody about that. But it's a good question.
Going back to the economic dimension of the problem, I would just like to draw attention to the role of the U.S. and the potential that it could play in helping Kosovo develop, and also making Kosovo's independence and so, a matter of economic sustainability. So I believe that the U.S. still has a role to play in it, and significantly, there is also a will on the part of the U.S. to continue its support, its economic support in Kosovo. And also would like to draw attention to Kosovo's potential in terms of economic development. It has a very good and former renowned ski resort in the south, which recently has signed a deal with a French consortium to invest for the next 10 years, and I believe the sum is in the hundreds of millions. So in terms of economic sustainability, I believe that it could it shouldn't be an argument against Kosovo's independence in that regard.
Okay, any further final questions anyone has? Yulia.
Sorry, just that maybe to be a bit of a devil's advocate, just the whole idea that this is all working out quite well, everyone is actually doing good for everybody. I mean, if we look at what's happening in Kosovo at the moment, that you have this political unrest and this deep, deep disagreement with the whole dialogue that the EU is pushing for, that they're so proud of, isn't this constructive incoherence, and when does it start becoming actually risky, and when does it actually... I have the feeling that locally people feel that because the EU is so concerned about this relationship with Serbia, so little is actually done in the country in strengthening the institutions and the rule of law, which is what ULEX was actually supposed to do. So do you acknowledge some kind of risk there as well, or what would be your prediction there? How long can this go on, basically?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's... it's not something that can sort of go on indefinitely. And I think it comes back to something we were talking about before, which is that at a certain point, this incoherence also starts to have material effects, right? So in instances such as, you know, mediating between Serbia and Kosovo, like, it's great to have this incoherence because you can be a trusted interlocutor, right? But at a certain point, the entire idea of EU accession, right, is that you dangle a carrot in front of Kosovo and Serbia, for that matter, you know, the entire Western Balkans countries, and say, hey, here's our list of demands, and then here's the carrot, right? And that works if the carrot is visible, right? But if you put the carrot on a stick that's 500 miles long, and you say, oh, by the way, you know, maybe there's a carrot, I don't know, the stick is so long I can't see, I mean... At a certain point, this falls apart, right? And I think that this is the problem with in general with the sort of EU enlargement process, right? Is that in order for the pressure to be there to do all these things, the institutional reforms, the democratization, the sort of political culture, right? I mean, if the EU says, listen, if you want to join in 5 years, you better get your political act together, they'd get their political act together. If the EU says, well, we'll continue the negotiations if you... It's not a credible carrot/stick, I think. So I think that's the problem with it, but I'm not sure that it's not just coherence that you would need then. You would also need a much firmer commitment to eventual EU enlargement, which then you actually can, and this goes back to your comment, pair with very strict criteria, and go back and say, okay, if you do actually meet all these criteria, then we will let you in any time after 2025, 2020, whatever. Right? That can work. But I think if it's this long drawn out process, I think it's shown that, and I think Serbia is the country that's showing how this is falling apart. Right? I mean, if you look at the Serbian population, the sort of even the willingness of the Serbian population to join the EU has diminished, right? And partially because it's taken so long. Turkey, even better example, right? You sort of teased Turkey along for decades now, and it does not really look like this whole Europeanization of Turkey is working very well, right? I mean, and I think there's, this is not the only reason, but this is one of the reasons.
But I think there's also another side of this. I mean, one can see that there's a stability angle that they want to try and sort of keep situation calm in Serbia. But also I get the feeling, for example, the current demonstrations that are taking place in Kosovo, the European Union hasn't spoken out loudly enough to say that, look, the deal that's been reached on the municipalities is perfectly in line and is actually part and parcel of European values, that this is a model that exists in many other European countries, that you have all principles of autonomy. And for example, one of the things I keep hearing is that people sort of say, but this is recreating Republika Srpska. This is like recreating Bosnia. Nonsense. It's not nothing like that at all. Nobody that I've spoken to would in their right minds want to advocate recreating a Bosnia model anywhere else ever again. It's a lot softer than that. But the European Union is not coming out and speaking particularly loudly on that. So I think, what we're seeing is that, I fully take on board, and I actually agree with you. I think this is very important, this constructive incoherence. But I also see the point you're just making. At some point, is this not actually hindering the development of both Serbia, to say to Serbia, look, you need to finally be done with the whole Kosovo story, and at the same time be saying to Kosovo, look, you need to be doing a lot more to also be done with this story. And part and parcel of that is recognising that you have a sizeable, it's not huge, but it's still a proportion who are, Serbian, who feel those links, who can have some sort of autonomy that isn't going to ruin the Kosovo state, and it's not been able to make that sort of position clear.
Yeah, and I think what it gets to, right, is that, and this is the sort of argument that I'm making, that for certain sort of foreign policy issues, incoherence may not be bad, but for instance, it's very hard to be incoherent and at the same time have a very robust vision for what you want Kosovo to look like. Right? I mean, you can't be incoherent on whether it exists and at the same time be like, whether or not you exist, you should look like this, and these are the minority laws you should have, and these are the, and this is the type of economy you should have, and here's how you should, fix your political culture. I mean, so you can't have both at the same time. I totally agree, right? But there's a lot of sort of literature out there that says, well, what Europe really needs is to figure out exactly what it wants, and then get a big hammer, and say this is what Kosovo should do, and I'm. Sort of my argument was saying, well, potentially, but then there are all these sort of other gains that might not have happened then, right? It might have a much sort of thornier relationship with Serbia right now, if that were the case. It might actually have a better functioning political culture and have a much more antagonistic relationship with Serbia, for instance. Right? So I don't think this is a sort of, it's not a total win in that sense.
But I think it does beg the question, doesn't it? How long is this sustainable? And where are we going? We very quickly. Do you want to have a final
last just point on what we were just talking about? The negotiating framework with Serbia basically has not one but two disavowal clauses, and normalization of the relations between Serbia and Kosovo is one of the second disavowal clauses, because we were speculating what time is it going to. So the idea is that once the chapters have started to be open, if there isn't sufficient progress in normalizing the relations between Belgrade and Pristina, negotiations could be put on hold because of lack of progress in that direction. And I mean, again, this is another example of the Commission creating another ambiguity rather than saying recognize,
exactly.
Just normalization, and how do we measure progress, nobody knows.
Yeah.
But I think that this could potentially at some point of time.
Yeah, and I think that the thing to keep in mind here, right, is that I think the EU learned a very tough lesson with Cyprus.
Oh, God.
The idea that you can bring countries into the EU and then solve their problems, I mean, that doesn't work, right? Because the one lever that you have is actually the membership, right? So you need to, I mean, you can see it in Croatia-Slovenia right now. Right?
Mm.
The whole peace process, or not peace process, I mean, they're peace, but the sort of border dispute process has stalled because Croatia is now in. It's not going to be resolved anytime in the next 10 years because nobody has any incentive to resolve it, right? So I don't, so apparently the EU hasn't learned this. But I think most people in the EU have learned this lesson or should have learned this lesson. And that's sort of a conflict that even if it doesn't get resolved, nobody cares, right?
Mm.
This is a conflict or an issue that needs to be resolved, right? Because people care. So, and it's important. So I don't, this is why I think, you know, this particular clause is important is that, and this is why I was saying that I can only see a sort of Big Bang enlargement in the Balkans. And again, some people disagree, right? But this is the reason I can only see that happening, because you need to figure all of this out with the sort of, you know, dangling threat of not letting them into the EU. And then once it's resolved, you can let them in. But the other way has been proven very nicely and empirically not to work. So I don't think the EU will try to import such conflicts into its already sort of muddled
yes.
geography.
Well, thank you very, very much for such an interesting talk, and thank you everyone for coming along this evening and participating so well.
And I hear
so
that you
well
skipped a party to come here, which is especially
yeah,
laudable,
some of them I think might have, yes. that, but anyway, thank you very, very much again. If we can show appreciation in the usual way, thank you.